questions? So, oh yes. So that's the problem where you put something on a spring and it says it compress. So you're going to set the force that's pushing it down to the spring force that's up. So it's going to be mg equals kx sort of thing. More questions? The quiz? So the quiz will basically be on, I could have given you the quiz today, right? But we didn't talk about it. So it'll be about the same sort of stuff that the homework was on last time, and we're going to be doing pretty much the same thing today also. So all of this stuff we're doing deals with simple harmonic motion and these equations that we've run into. More questions? So remember the lab practical next time. Most people have pretty good lab grades, so you don't want to spoil it by getting a lousy lab practical grade. And no reason to do that since we've given you the exam beforehand.
So is it going to be one of those options?
It'll either be one of those or a data set that's similar to those. So the exact phrase is in your lab manual, but the answer is www.physics.csbsdu/lab/practical. And there are 16 data sets there, 1 through 9 and A through F for practice. More questions? And maybe I'll give this one. So what lots of people are doing is they're doing those and then emailing them to me so I can tell them what's right and wrong. And the thing that people most frequently are getting wrong is units. And there's a link that's off of the main WAP page that describes how to get the units for those parameters if you've forgotten. More questions? So if you spend some time on the pre-lab stuff before lab, it's a breeze. It's a 15-minute easy thing to do. If you're just looking at it for the first time in lab, you're going to be real unhappy. That's my statement. More questions? And there's sign-up sheets that are on the door. Todd has said that you can sign up for his sections if you're in my section, so you can just sign up for any one of those that's convenient for you. Okay. So it's a lot of equations, so kind of the excuse for this is we've seen most of them before. So we have had this Hooke's law equation that says that the force that the spring pulls back on is proportional to the extension of the spring. The fact that it's pushing back is implicit in this minus sign, and the fact that it's proportional is that constant K, the spring constant, is a constant. We've had this equation for potential energy, and we've used that for conservation of energy problems before. So probably the only new stuff literally is this stuff here. That is to say, these equations that describe oscillations by using trigonometric functions and this particular relationship between angular frequency and the spring constant and mass. Right? We've had frequency and period when we were talking about rotational motion. So just to remind you about units, spring constant is newtons per meter. A radian doesn't literally have units, so you can leave that off if you want, but I'm happier saying that the units of angular frequency are radians per second. And for frequency, cycles doesn't literally have any units, so you could do it per seconds, but people like to use cycles per seconds or honor the famous dead physicist Hertz with that unit name. And of course, period is going to be measured in time. Obviously, since omega is in radians, you better put your calculator in radian modes if you actually use any of those three equations. This one here was just a consequence of conservation of energy that cropped up in a few problems. These particular problems often kind of hinge on a sign difference. The difference between whether we're talking about the work that the spring does or the work we do in drawing the bow or pushing the spring. And they're just opposite of each other. So we've said for a long time that the work done by a force is minus the change in potential energy. But now we're also talking about the work that we do in order to stretch the spring, and that's just minus what work is, which is to say it's equal to the change in potential energy. Questions?
The difference, could you just go over the difference between the A and the X in?
So A is a constant. It's called the amplitude, and I probably should have written that up here. And it's just the maximum deviation of X. More questions? Well, kind of the point of the next bit of the book is, of course, there are a lot of things that oscillate that aren't literally springs and masses. But we can deal with all of those cases usually by thinking of them as being approximately like springs and masses. And it's only kind of thinking about what is the equivalent spring and what is the equivalent mass. So the plan is to kind of go through some examples of things that oscillate that aren't literally springs and masses and see how you can figure out what the period of the motion is just by making the identification of the spring and the mass. So the usual way to do this is to, at least the way I usually do it, is to connect up to the equation for energy conservation. If you can make something look like that equation, then it'll have to have the corresponding omega. Another way of doing it is to look if you can make a connection between the acceleration and the position, then you can also pick out what omega is. Right, whatever this thing is in a different situation, that's going to be omega squared. And from omega, you can, of course, get the period. Okay, so let's kind of take a look at a typical example of that, and that's a pendulum. So if we look at a pendulum, it's something that's certainly oscillating, but it's not literally a mass on a spring. If we try and work the pendulum problem in kind of the old-fashioned way, the pendulum is, of course, going to be moving on a piece of a circle. And if we try and work this with conservation of energy, let's just call this angle theta, then we know that this is probably pulling something back from before. You might remember that if we have something that's moving in a circle, the velocity is the radius of that circle times the angular speed times omega. So the kinetic energy in this case is going to be 1/2 m times the velocity squared. Incidentally, another way of thinking about this is that the kinetic energy is the moment of inertia times omega squared. And the moment of inertia, you might remember, is the mass times the distance squared. So either way, we have that for the kinetic energy. What do we have for the potential energy? Well, gravitational potential energy is mgh. So what we need to find is how high is the pendulum bob from the bottom. Assuming that we've chosen h equals 0 to be at the bottom. I guess we didn't have to do that, but that's kind of the logical thing to do. Well, that's kind of an odd thing to calculate. It would have been a lot easier to calculate this distance here. Right? That distance there is just given to us by trigonometry. Since it's a side that's adjacent to that angle theta, that distance is going to be L cosine theta. And of course, this is a piece of a circle, so from there to there is going to be L, and h is just the difference between those two. Right, so h has to be equal to l minus l cosine theta, which I can factor out the l if I want to. Okay, so the potential energy is mgh. So we have mgl 1 minus cosine theta. And conservation of energy then tells us for this pendulum that the energy is 1 half ml squared times omega squared plus mgl 1 minus cosine theta. And we're supposed to make a comparison between that and what we have for the simple harmonic oscillator. And boy, it doesn't look very similar. Well, this was angular velocity, and that was actual velocity, so those things kind of match up. But I don't see how things match up with the other sort of equation, and they don't. They don't literally exactly match up. But it turns out that you can approximate 1 minus cosine theta. It's very close to theta squared over 2. So if you've taken calculus, you might remember Taylor series expansions, and that's where this sort of thing is proved. But pretty much, 1 minus cosine theta is theta squared over 2. And now things maybe look a little bit more similar. Because now I can kind of match up the theta squared and the x squared. And it's pretty clear then that the thing that is like k is this quantity here, mgl. And the thing that is like m is this thing here, ml squared. And we know that if we take the thing that's like k and divide it by the thing that's like m, we're supposed to get the angular frequency squared. You can see lots of things are going to cancel out here. And we get then that the angular frequency of the pendulum should be the square root of GL. And therefore, of course, since the period is 2 pi over omega, the period should be the square root of L over G. Yes?
On the bottom there, is it M plus ML?
No, so I'm making this analogy. The thing that's like m is ml squared. And the thing that's like k is mgl. And I claim that if I can match up the energies that we have for a complicated situation to the energies that we have for a spring, we can kind of read off what the corresponding omega is. Okay, well, that's what's called a simple pendulum. We have something that's more complicated, right? This thing will also oscillate back and forth, but it's not literally a mass on a string. So things like this, real situations, are usually called physical pendulums. How does that change things? Well, you remember that if we have a complicated object, so let's say that object is going to pivot about that point, everything really depends on the location of the center of mass. So in particular, if I call the distance to the center of mass L, then the corresponding gravitational potential energy will be mg times the height of that center of mass. And just like before, that'll be mgl 1 minus cosine theta, where theta is the angle that this physical object has gone through. Now, for a simple point mass, we could say that the moment of inertia was ml squared, but not for something that's a complicated object. Who knows what the moment of inertia is of that complicated object? So under these circumstances, instead of knowing what the moment of inertia is, I have to just use I have to look up the moment of inertia in one of those tables. And now this L is the distance to the center of mass, not the length of the pendulum. But everything else is pretty much the same, right? So instead of having mgl, instead of having ml squared, we're going to have I. And so what we're going to have for our final formula for omega squared is going to be that. And then the corresponding period for a physical pendulum, 2 pi over omega, is going to give us that. Okay, so by matching up the kinetic energy and potential energy terms for a general situation, we can often figure out what the corresponding period is going to be. Okay, so that's one way of dealing with more general situations. The other way of dealing with more general situations is to look at the force equation. So one problem in the book is as follows. We have a big rubber band that is held fixed between two locations, and we've got a blob that's sitting in the center of those two rubber bands. If we displace this blob forward, the rubber bands are going to stretch, and you know, if I release it, this thing is going to go twang, right? It's going to go up and down. What's going to be the frequency of that oscillation? Well, so if we displace this thing some distance y, what's the force that's pushing it back? Well, the force are these tensions that are on either side. And you can see that the horizontal component, so let me kind of draw a bigger picture of that. So there's the tension from one rubber band. There's the supposedly equal tension from the other rubber band. We can break those up into each one of them into x and y components. And we can see that the total force that's pushing down is going to be those two forces. So let me put some symbols on here. So let me call the half length of this rubber band L. And what we should have then is this total force should be twice one of those forces. And one of those forces would be the tension times the sine of this angle. And that angle is the same as this angle. And we can calculate the sine of this angle by the Pythagorean theorem, right? So we take the opposite over the hypotenuse. So this force is going to be 2t times y divided by the square root of y squared plus l squared. And we know that F is equal to ma, so we have the mass times the acceleration of this object. This is a restoring force, so we have a minus sign. It's going to be 2 times the tension times y divided by the square root of y squared plus l squared. Now again, that doesn't look exactly like this equation, right? We've got the a's matching up. That's looking good, but we don't just have y, we've got this other stuff too. But as long as y is small compared to l, this denominator is about going to equal l. Right? So if this is a meter and this is a millimeter, the hypotenuse is still going to be pretty much a meter. So if we make that approximation, now we have things that kind of match up. The thing that's, and let me kind of rewrite this with the m over here, the mass is exactly equal to the mass, and the thing that is like k is this 2t over l. So under these circumstances, omega squared is the thing that's like k divided by the thing that's like m, and the thing that's like k is 2t over l, and the thing that's like m is m. And so we've got then that the angular frequency is going to be the square root of 2t over ml. Not super easy, huh? Well, yeah, I think I agree. That is, in fact, though, what problem 72 is about. Okay, so let's take a look at problem 73. So, and we can even generalize problem 73 a little bit. Let's say we wanted to make a rapid transit system that could take us to California as fast as possible. So obviously what we want to do is to drill a straight hole to California. And if you think about it, this would be downhill. So we could just slide downhill, and we could slide uphill, and we could get off the train in California. No fuel used. 100% efficiency. So how long would it take for this process to go? So you can see the problem that they're thinking about in the book is we do something that's a little bit more difficult, is we go right through the Earth. So we go, well, not to China, but to Australia or someplace, wrong hemisphere. And since the interior of the Earth is liquid, it's kind of hard to put a tunnel through it. But I don't know, California, it's mostly solid, although it's moving a little bit. So we can at least imagine having this tunnel. Okay, so here we are halfway along. What is the force that's pushing us? Well, of course, the force is the force of gravity, which is pointing right towards the center of the circle, but we only care about the component of that force that is exactly horizontal. That's the only thing that's going to be driving us downhill. So how do we figure out what that force is? So let's back up for a second and remember what we learned in, I don't know, an earlier chapter. If we made a plant, so there are actually people who thought that the Earth was a shell, like an eggshell. And then instead of living on the inside, outside of this shell, we lived on the inside of this shell. It's not right, right? There are flat Earth societies. There are people who have all sorts of weird ideas. This is on the list. So what is the force on this guy, right? So there's all this rock that's right below him. Presumably that's going to be holding him down. Does it actually work that way? And it's not an exactly easy calculation, right? There is all of this rock that is 12,000 miles away that is pulling him the other way. We have to add up all of those forces to figure out what the force would be on somebody inside such a shell. And the answer is zero. You can float around just fine inside this spherical shell because there's no net force. The net effect of all of that mass is nothing. So what that means is if we have a solid Earth, so let's drill a hole through the Earth, as again, not easy to do since it's liquid on the inside, or at least part of the inside. If we ask what the force is on this guy, we can eliminate the effect of all of the mass that's exterior to the guy. The effect of all of that mass is zero. So the only thing we need to concern ourselves about is the mass that's interior to the guy. How much mass is there? Well, we can calculate that. because we know that the mass is the density of the Earth, I think that's about 6 grams per cubic centimeter, times the volume of the sphere, which is 4/3 pi r cubed. And we know from Newton's law of gravity that the force on this guy is Newton's gravitational constant, the mass that's pulling him down, his mass divided by his distance to the center of that concentration squared. So if we plug in what we have for the mass that's interior of that guy, we've got Newton's gravitational constant, 4/3 r cubed times the density, the guy's mass divided by r squared. And you can see we get a lot of cancellation. So the net force on this guy is g rho 4/3 times r times his mass. Okay, so this force that's pulling right straight towards the center of the Earth, that's g rho 4/3 r times the mass of the train that is going downhill. Yes?
Where did the pi go?
So it went wrong. So starting right here, there should have been a pi. Thank you. Okay. Yes?
I don't exactly get what's happening in that picture. So something's going downhill. Is that what you're trying to like?
Yeah. So the direction to California is downhill, right?
Sure.
Straight. I mean, if you go in a straight line.
Okay.
Right? It's hard to dig to California, but if you're ambitious and you have a good shovel, just go west, young man, and a little bit down too. Okay. Well, so we only want the component of the force that's actually pushing us along the incline. And we can do kind of the same trick we did before, right? So really what we need is the sine of this angle times that force. And the sine of that angle is going to be the hypotenuse times this distance. I don't know, let me call that distance x. So this force that's pushing us along is this force here. Let me just call it F to be short. Times the sine of the angle, and the sine of the angle is just x divided by r. So the upshot then, if I plug in this force, is the r's cancel. So I've got g rho 4/3 pi, the mass of the train, times x. Yeah. Subway, I guess it's a subway. Going underground, mostly.
Wait, are we doing number 73?
Pretty much. We're doing it even more generally.
Where's the train?
So, I'm not sure if this thing is made with a train or just directly falling. I kind of don't like going through the center of the Earth. It's a straight shot, of course, but it gets kind of wavy on the inside. So we're doing a general case where we're going to California instead of Australia. And kind of the amazing story here is it doesn't matter whether you're going to California or St. Ben's or Australia by this straight line approach. It takes the same time either way. All right, so you can do the same thing. You can go to St. Ben's. It's slightly downhill. If you take the direct straight line approach, slightly downhill, and since it's only slightly downhill, there's not a big force pushing you down, so you're not going to accelerate very fast. You don't have very far to go. You know, how does that all work out? And what you'll see is it works out so that it doesn't matter whether you're going to St. Ben's or Minneapolis or Chicago or Los Angeles or Australia. It takes the same time.
Yeah, I was just wondering how we're relating falling through the center of the earth with oscillating springs.
Yeah, it hasn't. We haven't gotten there yet. I totally agree. But we're about to get there. And you can see the start of it right here. Because what we've got is a force that's proportional to x. And that's exactly how a spring works.
So all the other stuff is the equivalent of a k?
So this is all just like k. So what we have here is something that looks exactly like a spring, right? The force is pushing us back when we're at some positive distance x. And so we can write down F equals ma. So the mass of the train times the acceleration is this force times x. The mass of the train, kind of no surprise for gravitational problems, cancels out. When we calculate omega squared, we take k over m. And so that's going to be g, the density of the Earth, 4/3 pi. And therefore, the period, the time it's going to take us to go from here to California and back, is going to take 2 pi divided by the square root of g rho 4/3 pi. And if you just want to go to California, of course, it's half of that. So I don't know, how long is the trip? St. Ben's. So first of all, you can see that the answer doesn't depend on where you're going, right? So the full length of oscillation doesn't enter into our answer. It's that time, no matter which way you're going. So the only question is, how long does it take? Well, so the density of the Earth, I don't know, isn't something that I think is in our book very conveniently. So it's probably going to be smart to rewrite the density of the Earth as the mass of the Earth divided by the volume of the Earth. And then this period that we're going to get is 2 pi over the square root of Newton's gravitational constant, and we have now this formula for rho to put in. So that's the mass of the Earth divided by 4/3 pi r cubed. And we've got 4/3 pi, which looks nicely set up to cancel a lot of things out. So far, so good. So what we've got is t, this is an r cubed in the denominator of the denominator. So we have r to the 3/2, the radius of the Earth to the 3/2, 2 pi divided by the square root of gm. And we can look up in our book what the Newton's gravitational constant is and what the mass of the Earth is. And the answer is 84 minutes. Right, so 42 minutes to go to California by the straight line approach. No fuel required. Just have to have a slippery surface. So what we're doing is we're making a correspondence to this equation. And what we see is that, you know, m is m, and all of that is k. And we know that this is what's going to be the case. So we solve the problem of the motion by making an analogy to a spring. And that's most oscillations that you encounter in life aren't as simple as that. So the plan is to either by this sort of process or by the energy sort of process, make the mathematics look like a spring. And then you can just read off what the period is.
So why does the X disappear there?
Because what we're doing is we're matching up these equations. So the thing that's like X is X. So the thing that everything else is has to be like K. It is a constant, right? Density of the Earth, Newton's gravitational constant.
So you're not really using that equation, you're just labeling them there.
Yeah, so I'm just seeing that this thing is like K and mass is like mass, and therefore the omega squared is given by K, the equivalent K over the equivalent mass. So that's the plan for working these things, either through energy conservation or by F equals ma, pick off the thing that's like mass, pick off the thing that's like K, and then you can work the corresponding real world problem. Okay. Okay, so those are kind of new sorts of problems. Here we have more similar sorts of problems. Well, 34 is kind of a new type of, is kind of a repeat of what we've got here. It's more or less a plug and chug on this pendulum equation that we've just derived. So this guy sees a pendulum, you know, kind of like the one in New Science. This one has a period that is 15.5 seconds, and we're supposed to figure out how long the string is. And we know that the equation for the period of a pendulum is 2 pi times the square root of the length divided by g. And we want to solve this equation for the length. So if we square both sides, what we've got is t squared is equal to 2 pi squared L over G. And finally, what we've got is T squared times G divided by 2 pi squared is equal to L. And it's just a plug and chug, right? So we've got the period is 15.5 seconds. G is 9.8 meters per second squared. And 2 pi is 2 pi squared. We can take a look at our units. We've got second squared here and second squared there. 2 pi is unitless, so we're going to get out our length in meters. So we've got 15.5 squared times 9.8, and we're supposed to divide by 2 and multiplied by pi, which is then squared. And the answer is 59.6 meters. Okay, so that's just a plug and chug using the pendulum equation. And that is G, so if we go someplace else, we go to the moon where G is just 1.67, and we're asked how long it's going to take that pendulum to swing. Well, it's also just another plug and chug. So the period then is going to be 2 pi times the length, which we just calculated, is 59.6 divided by the acceleration of gravity. We can check our units. This was meters. This was meters per second squared. The meters go away. We've got second squared in the denominator of the denominator, so it comes upstairs to a second squared and take the square root, and we're pretty much all set. So we got 2, we got pi, and we've got 59.6 and 1.67, divide those things, take the square root, and I get 37.5 seconds. Okay, kind of no surprise, smaller number in the denominator means a longer period. So the period is basically more than doubled by this process. Okay, so the most similar problem to what we've been doing is this guy here. So here we have a spring that you compress it by 2 centimeters and then you let go of it and it goes up to 60 centimeters. And we're supposed to estimate what the spring constant is. So this is an energy conservation problem. The kind of new thing here is we have more than one type of energy. We don't just have spring potential energy, we've also got gravitational potential energy. So in the initial state, we've got this highly compressed spring. I might as well call that height 0. So the initial energy, there's no kinetic energy, it's not moving. There's no gravitational potential energy because I defined the height to be 0 where it's starting. But there's a certain amount of spring potential energy because I compressed it by the 2 centimeters. When this thing pops up to the top, reaches some maximum height h, which they tell us is 60 centimeters, under these circumstances, there is no kinetic energy because it's reached the top and it's about to reverse its direction, so it has 0 velocity there at the top. It's got some gravitational potential energy, which is mgh, and the problem tells us that h is 0.6 meters. And the spring is sitting down here uncompressed, right? So there's no spring potential energy. And conservation of energy tells us that the initial energy and the final energy have to be exactly the same thing. So they tell us that the mass of this thing is 0.1 kilograms. So we've got 0.1 kilograms times g times its height, and that is all supposed to equal 1/2 the unknown spring constant times 0.02 squared. So if we just rearrange this equation, we've got k is equal to the 0.1, the 9.8, the 0.6 meters, the 2 can come upstairs, and we have the 0.02 squared. Down below. Now let's check our units. So you might remember that we're looking for k to have units of newtons per meter, and what we've got are kilograms meters per second squared times meters, and of course these guys go together to give us a newton. So we've got a newton meter upstairs, and we've got a meter squared down squared downstairs. So we're certainly going to get out newtons per meter in the end. Okay, so in terms of numbers, we got 0.1, we got 9.8, we got 0.6, and we've got 2, and we got 0.02 that we're supposed to square and divide, and I get 2.94. times 10 to the third newtons per meter. Yep. Okay, so energy conservation. Nothing new, but maybe it's so old that we've kind of forgotten about it. Same thing applies to this problem, right? So this is going to be a momentum conservation problem. So we're going to have a quasi-collision with this bullet that's going to transfer a certain amount of momentum to the block. The bullet is going to penetrate through the block, and they give us some information, and they're basically asking us for how fast is the bullet going to emerge from the block. Okay, so we've got incoming momentum that just is in the bullet. We've got outgoing momentum that is in part in the block and in part in the bullet. And we're supposed to figure out what's happening here at the end. Okay, so conservation of momentum, that's that mass times velocities are the same before and after. So we have that the mass of the block, which I'll use a capital M for, is 1 kilogram. And we have the mass of the bullet as being 5 grams. And we've got the initial speed of the bullet to be 400 meters a second. And what momentum conservation says is the initial momentum, which is the mass of the bullet times the initial velocity of the bullet, that all has to equal the final momentum, which is in part the final velocity of the block, which we don't know, and the mass of the bullet times its final velocity, which we also don't know. So that's not looking particularly good, right? One equation, two unknowns is bad, right? We want as many unknowns as we can get. Well, they've given us a lot of other information. And what's going to happen, of course, is once this velocity is transferred to the block, it's going to start moving in this direction and compressing the spring. And what's going to happen is its initial kinetic energy is going to be converted into spring potential energy. So if we look at the post-collision compression of the spring, we have an initial energy that is the velocity of the block. The spring is at this point uncompressed. And we've got a final energy in which the block isn't moving anymore, but the spring has been compressed by some amount that they tell us. Right? It's been compressed by 5 centimeters. And they've also told us the spring constant of the spring is 900. So as the spring is compressed, we're going to have conservation of energy. So the initial energy, which is 100% kinetic, is going to be converted into the final energy, which is 100% potential. And we can use this equation then, because we know everything in this equation except VB. So we can figure out what the velocity is of the block post-collision. Okay, so let's do that. So we have 1/2 the mass of the block times VB squared. That has to be 1/2 the spring constant times the compression squared. So the 1/2s go away. And the post-collision velocity of the block has to be kx squared divided by the mass of the block. So they tell us that k is 900. They tell us that x is 5 centimeters, and they tell us that the mass of the block is 1. Okay, so we got 900 and 0.05 squared multiplied through all of that, take the square root, and the velocity of the block post-collision is 1.5 meters a second. So now I know everything in this equation, right? The mass of the bullet is 5 grams. The initial velocity is 400 meters a second. The mass of the block is 1 kilogram. So the only thing that's unknown is the velocity of the bullet after it penetrates the block. Okay, so I guess we can plug and chug this. So we've got 400 for our speed and 0.005. So this is an initial momentum that is exactly 2. And 1 times 1.5 we can do in our heads. It's 1.5. So what we have then is 2 minus 1.5, right, which we can also do in our heads. That's 0.5. That has to be the mass of the bullet times the final velocity of the bullet. So we got 0.5 and 0.005 divided by, and the final velocity, that's the 0.5 of momentum that's left over divided by the 0.005 is 100 meters a second. Okay, so the bullet came in at 400 meters a second. It's going to leave at 100 meters a second. 1.5 units of momentum are going to be transferred to the block. That kinetic energy is going to be converted into potential energy, and we're going to have the spring compressed by 5 centimeters. Okay, so we can combine all of this test 2 stuff with springs to make even more fun problems. Questions? Well, we've got some spare time. Let's do one of the assigned homework problems. Yeah, I'll do the last one, which has got to be the hardest one, right? But if you look at the last one, it's actually a whole lot similar to ones that we've worked before, right? So it's the old spring toy gun, and they tell us what the spring constant is, and they tell us that we're going to compress the spring in the gun 20 centimeters, and we're going to have a 2-gram pellet that's going to be propelled forward, and we're supposed to find the muzzle speed of the bullet, and then we're supposed to figure out, you know, kind of using test 2 sort of stuff, what's the range of the bullet. Okay, so it's a pretty similar problem to what we've worked, right? We have this highly compressed spring in this bullet. And what's going to happen is all of this potential energy that's stored in that spring, it's going to be converted into kinetic energy when the bullet exits the gun. And then we have an old-fashioned problem where we know that this bullet is going to have a path kind of like that, and we're supposed to figure out where it hits the ground. Let's do the second part of the problem first, or at least start the second part of the problem first, because that's what we haven't done for the longest time. This is just conservation of energy. It's going to look just exactly like the other problems that we've worked. And this is, of course, old stuff, but it's old enough that who's going to remember it? So this range problem, right, the shoot the dinosaur problem, you remember kind of the key word, the key understanding is that the dropped object is going to take just as long as the bullet is to fall. So how long is it going to take for a dropped object to fall some general distance? We know it's going to be 1 meter, but let's have it be a general distance of h. And go back to your test 1 cheat sheet, and you've got the following equations, which are certainly going to be on your final cheat sheet. We've got x is equal to x naught plus v sub ot plus 1/2 at squared, and the velocity is equal to the initial velocity plus at. And we've got v squared minus v naught squared is equal to 2a x minus x naught, which I think these things are called delta x in our book. So mostly we're not going to use these equations. We're just going to use this guy here. But I remind you about them all. They're all Now I might as well write the other one on there too, which is that the average velocity calculated that way is the same as the average velocity calculated as a change in distance divided by time. But this is the guy we're going to use. So typically, we use the y-axis going up. But that's just going to produce all sorts of minus signs. And it just, for this particular problem, it makes, to me, a lot more sense to take the y-axis going down. If I do that, then the acceleration is going to be plus 9.8 meters a second. I can do it the other way, but then remember that g is going to be minus, and the height is going to be minus. There are going to be all sorts of minus signs. This dropped object is dropped at zero velocity, and we can choose our origin to be at that same spot. So what we're going to have then is this fall distance is going to be 1/2 g t squared. So the particular time it takes to reach the bottom, we can calculate by that process. So if we bring the 2 up and the g down, what we've got is 2h divided by g square rooted is equal to the time. Okay, so that's how much time it's going to take before it hits the ground. Where is it going to go? Well, the horizontal motion is not accelerated. So there's no, the acceleration is zero, so there's no term like that. So the distance it's going to go horizontally is just going to be its initial velocity in the x direction times the time, and we're particularly interested in this time, which is when it's going to hit the ground. So we've got v sub o x square root of 2h over g. So, I don't know, maybe you're feeling unhappy at this point. Let me comment that the quiz tomorrow will not attempt to combine test 2 stuff with our test stuff. But you should be ready for these sorts of questions on the final. And you can see that it's stuff that I have you doing for homework. Okay, so we know the height, we know g. This velocity, this muzzle velocity, is what we were supposed to calculate in the first part, and that's just conservation of energy. In the initial state, we have this highly compressed spring, which has no kinetic energy, but it has lots of potential energy. In the final state, the spring is sitting here uncompressed, so there is lots of kinetic energy, but no spring potential energy. Conservation of energy tells us that the initial energy is equal to the final energy, that all of this potential energy is going to be converted into kinetic energy when the spring expands. So we've got 1/2 k x squared is going to be 1/2 m v squared. 1/2s go away, so we have k over m, x squared, square rooted. That's going to be the initial muzzle velocity. So they've told us that the spring has, oops, not up there anymore, is it? The spring has a spring constant of, that's kind of confusing. So the spring constant is 9.8, okay, but they mean it. The spring constant is 9.8 newtons per meter. And the mass of the pellet was, I thought, 1 gram, and there was a 20 centimeter compression. So x is 0.2, k is 9.8, but it's not g, and m is 0.01. So we got 0.2, we're supposed to square it, and we've got 9.8, and we've got 0.001 divided by, take the square root, and pretty much 2, but more precisely 1.98 meters per second. Now that we've got the muzzle velocity, we know that the height is 1, g is 9.8, so we've got 1.98 times the square root of 2 divided by 9.8. And I get 8.9 meters. So I probably should have worked an odd problem so we could see whether I got it right or not. But I got it right, obviously. I guess you get to check, don't you? Because you can put it into WebAssign and see whether it worked or not. Questions? So rather than work all of your homework, I think I'll call it quits. So let me spend, So is everyone clear about the lab practical stuff? What people are missing is units.
So we can just work those and email you.
You can work them, and that's what people have been doing them. You don't have to work all of them, but work a good fraction of them.
Okay.
Well, at least work 3 or 4 of them and send them to me, and then we can see whether we're on the right track or not.
Yeah, I definitely would.
There's a web page that's off the main web page that talks about how to deal with units. The other thing that people miss are sig figs. And if you look at the lab practical way at the bottom of the page, there's something that's called, I think, errorcode11.pdf. That shows how we're going to grade your thing. What are the things that are significant? And you know what they are: sig figs, errors, units, scales on the graph, spreadsheet that is self-documented, all of the usual stuff.
I know.